I want to continue with the story of Christianity that we began last week. We are going to have to take a break from this for the next couple of weeks because of some other things we've got going on in the 1:30 sessions. But so this story just keeps on going. It goes all the way to the present, though. So we'll just keep going whenever we get a chance. But last time I introduced this first 300-year period, the Ante-Nicene period, as it's called, under three major categories: the cradle, the cross, and the crown. Speaking of the birth of the church, the context in which the church was born, the cross of the church, beginning with the cross of Christ and the persecution of the church, and then, of course, the crown, referring to Constantine and the eventual victory of the church in the early 4th century. And so let's just continue with that theme today. And what I want to do is begin with a short discussion of Christianity as a historical religion. What do we mean by that? When we say that Christianity is a historical religion, it's actually rooted in historical context. And then secondly, we'll look at Christianity's great doctrine and see how this fueled the early church and its growth. And then we'll talk about what I think of as Rome's greatest failure, the persecution of the church. Rome did many things very well, but one thing that it really sought to do was to crush the church. And in this, it failed utterly. And we'll look at that today. I want to begin, though, by introducing you to this man right here. I'm sorry he doesn't show up all that well, but his name is Selim Yalcin. Selim Yalcin. He is a Muslim. He is a tour guide in Turkey. In fact, he's one of the most respected and well-known tour guides in all of Turkey. When our former president, George Bush's wife, Laura Bush, was in Turkey, he was her guide. That's the reputation of this man. And he took a real interest in us as Christians and what we were interested in as we toured around Turkey. And we really wanted to go see the city of Colossae. And Selim told us, well, you don't want to go to Colossae. There's really nothing there. It's just a great big mound that's never been excavated. And our group just insisted, we've got to go see Colossae. And he says, well, there's nothing there. I'm just telling you, it's a great big mound. Just nothing to see there. We say, you don't understand. We've got to go to Colossae. I mean, we have a letter in the Bible to the Colossians, and we just got to at least go to the location. And he says, well, I'm telling you, I've been there before, and I assure you they've done no work there at all since I was there last time. There's just no reason to go there. And so we're going back and forth with them, and finally, you know, we break him down, and he agrees to take us to Colossae. And along the way, we were looking at some of the guidebooks, and the guidebooks describe Colossae as a great big disappointing mound. And of course, Selim was thinking, see, I told you guys. So we get to Colossae, and to Salim's surprise, we all jump out of the bus, and we go running all over this great, big, disappointing mound with great enthusiasm. And he is actually shocked by this. What is with you Christians that just sort of run around these big mounds for no earthly reason? Let me show you what Colossae looks like. There it is, and there we are running around that great, big mound. And Selim is over here, and he's just pondering what it is that we're doing. There it is again. Many of you know Fred Coleman. This is Fred Coleman over here. He's my traveling buddy. And here it is again. And what you see actually right here in that kind of bowl shape is the theater. It's never been excavated, but archaeologists assume that that's where the theater was located. And really quite a beautiful location. And I really got to talking to Selim about this. And what I came away from was this, came away from this conversation was this, that Christianity is rooted very deeply in actual historical locations, in real places, and concerns real people and real events. And when you look at Islam and you read the Quran, it's not rooted in history in the same way. Anyone ever read the Quran? That's what I thought. All right. It's actually not that interesting. There's almost no history in it whatsoever. It's a very esoteric book. It's sort of mystical. It's really hard to sort of grasp what the author is even trying to say. There's nothing there that you can really identify with. It's not real people and real places and real locations that you can go check out or that archaeologists can actually uncover. And this is what I think was so unusual to Selim, that we Christians really think of our faith as rooted in things that have actually happened. And the Lord has given us an archaeological record that we can go investigate and see that these things are really true. And we are talking about God coming into human history and acting in human history dying a death that humans die and resurrecting in the context of human history. This is why history, I think, is so interesting. I know sometimes you think of it as events and dates and so forth. Don't think of it that way. Think about it as the theater in which God is actually acting. That's what's going on in history. So let's go back, and let me just show you a few other places in addition to Colossae that are locations where the story is going to explode. The story of the first followers of Jesus Christ. Here's Pergamum. We do read in the book of Revelation of a church there at Pergamos, as it's called in Revelation, or Pergamum, as it's called today, a really beautiful city in Asia Minor. This is where the Bible talks about Satan's seat being. There was a great temple there that archaeologists think may have been this what the Bible was referring to by Satan's seat. We went there at a really nice time when all the poppies were in bloom. And you can see the theater here. Nearly any good-sized city would have a theater. And I'm told by archaeologists that if you want to estimate the size of a city, you basically take the capacity of the theater and multiply times 10. I don't know why they came up with this formula, but apparently most of them go with this. So you can imagine how big a city that was just by imagining how many people could have sat in that theater and multiplied times 10. Down here at the bottom, you can't see it, but there's actually some people standing down here. And I was actually, from my vantage point, eavesdropping on them. I could hear every word that they were saying, even though they weren't shouting. That's how good the acoustics are in this place. And whenever you see a theater like this that's sort of built into the hillside, it's typically a Greek theater. Greeks like to sit in their theaters and look out over all the landscape beyond. What the Romans would do is build up a great big backdrop, so you couldn't look beyond a theater. You were supposed to focus on the stage. But Greeks wanted you to look around a little bit. So this is a Greek theater here at Pergamos. Thyatira, another church that we read about in Revelation. We don't have any extant archaeological remains from the first century, but this is a very, very large church, a basilica that's Byzantine. It dates to about the 5th century, and it's an indication that Christianity did, in fact, persist there at Thyatira, after the first century. You can imagine how many people could have sat in a room like that. Also in Sardis, there were still some archaeological remains of a church. This little building that you see down here in the foreground, that's a little church. And you can see it there, a little choir area in the background. Would have been a very small choir. And Philadelphia, all that remains there are three pillars. This is two of them, of what would have been a very, very, very large church. You can imagine how big a church these pillars would have supported. One of these pillars is still under the ground. But it's an indication that as late as the 5th century, there's still a really thriving church here in this location. Hierapolis, we don't read of this in the New Testament, but according to tradition, this is where Philip came. And Philip, according to tradition, is buried here. There's the main road into the city. And then if you take this little walkway up the hillside, right up on top here is the church. And it was an octagon-shaped church. And somewhere in there, I'm told that Philip is buried. We didn't see a grave marker, but according to tradition, this is where Deacon Philip is buried. And then Laodicea. We looked at this last time. Great big synagogue there. And here's the remains of the theater. Hasn't been rebuilt by archaeologists. Sometimes when you go to these sites and you see it looks like it's been preserved really well, a lot of times what that means is the archaeologists have actually got there to rebuild it. You can imagine how long it would take to rebuild all of that. It takes years and years and years. In fact, with Colossae, they said, well, maybe in about 40 years we'll get to it. And even after that, it'll probably take 10, 15 years to excavate. So we may never see what's down there in our lifetime. But in Laodicea, there are some indications of Christians that were there. And you see the symbol of the cross. There was actually several different crosses that we saw there at Laodicea. And this very quickly emerged as the symbol of Christianity, the symbol of the cross, as an indication that there were, in fact, Christians here. Understand what this meant in the ancient world. This would be the equivalent of an electric chair or a lethal syringe. This is your symbol of hope. This is the symbol of your church. This is how the Romans viewed it. It's an instrument of torture. And yet it becomes the symbol of the world's hope. And then Ephesus, the grandest of the cities there in Asia Minor. That building that you see in the background there is the famous Library of Celsus. Archaeologists have reconstructed this. It hasn't lasted like that through all these centuries. And then if you read in Acts chapter 19 of this great riot that broke out in Ephesus over the goddess Diana, and I remember Paul wanted to go in and quiet the whole thing down. The town clerk finally got in there after 2 hours of chanting, "Great is the goddess of Diana," and so forth. This is where they were. This is where all that chanting took place, and where they were very, very upset by Paul's disruption of the trade of idols and so forth. And you can go up inside the theater. And as you look out this main walkway here, this would have gone down to the coast. At one point, this was all water down in this area. But the Kaistra River comes along in this direction, and it eventually silted up the entire harbor. And so Ephesus lost its sort of pride of place. It lost its harbor, basically, and it was abandoned. And that's why there's so many ruins there to this day. Up on the hillside is a huge church, a Byzantine church, probably 5th or 6th century. And it's there that, according to very good tradition, we have the tomb of St. John, St. John the Apostle. And most scholars do believe this is, in fact, where John was buried. While we were at Ephesus, we had a man on our tour that really was moved by this tour. He had been saved, but he had never really given his life to follow Christ. And he came under deep conviction that he had never been baptized. In fact, this conviction was so urgent that he talked to one of the pastors on the tour. He said, "Can I just go ahead and get baptized right here on this tour? Because I don't want to wait till I go home. I want to make sure I do it right now." And so the pastor said, "Sure, I'll baptize you." So we got the whole tour group together, brought them down to the Aegean, where Paul would have baptized. And we invited Salim to come. And Salim walked right out in the water and wanted to know what this was. And as soon as the baptism had taken place, Salim came right up in my face and said, "Tell me about this. What is this all about? I've never seen this before." And I said, "I'd be happy to tell you about it. Let's just sit down here on the beach." And I had my Bible with him, and I began to talk to him about Christianity and about Islam. And he started right away making some comparisons between Islam and Christianity and thought they were basically the same thing. And I asked him some questions about the Quran, and he eventually said, "You know what, actually, I've never actually read the Quran. This is a Muslim guide." And I said, "Well, Salim, I have. I'd like to talk to you about it." So imagine that, talking to a Muslim about his holy book. I said, "Did you know that the Quran actually tells us that Jesus was a good man? And that Muhammad tells us we should read the Bible." He says, "Oh, yes, yes, I knew that was in there." I said, "Well, let me read you something in the Bible. In Galatians chapter 1, Paul tells us, if I or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you, let him be accursed." In fact, this is so serious that he repeats it a second time. "If I or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel, let him be accursed." And I said, "I have a dilemma here. Because Muhammad says to read the Bible, but the Bible curses Muhammad. Because he claimed to receive additional revelation from Gabriel. So what do you make of that?" And Salim says, "I had no idea that was in there. Tell me more." Which I was really shocked about. So I began to explain my way right to the Bible. And as Jason suggested this morning, we began in Genesis 1 and verse 1, where God begins, and we start working our way all the way through the Bible. And we come to the person of Jesus Christ, and he's very, very intrigued by Jesus. But what is it that sets Jesus apart? What is it that really sets Jesus apart from Muhammad, from Buddha, from any other religious leader? And if we can really discover what that thing is that sets him apart, I think that we can have an angle when it comes to reaching some of these people for Jesus Christ. And it's in that context, then, that I want to talk to you about Christianity's great doctrine, the great doctrine of Christianity. And I call it the great doctrine because this is the doctrine that really fueled the early church. This is the doctrine that they talked about constantly. This is the doctrine that is mentioned in every sermon in the book of Acts. And I'm referring to the doctrine of the resurrection. The resurrection of Jesus Christ from the grave. 2 weeks ago, my philosophy of religion class read a piece by the Buddha. It's a very intriguing piece. This student comes to Buddha, and he says to him, Would you please explain to me the mysteries of the world? Would you please explain to me where we came from, what the meaning of life is, whether there's any hope for an afterlife? And the Buddha responds by saying, I shall not explain those things to you. Those are not important questions. The only thing that I will explain to you is the origin of misery and suffering and what can be done about it. Now, I suggest to you that those are important questions. And Jesus does not avoid those questions. He answers those questions, every one of them. This last week, we looked at another philosopher whose name is Epicurus. Epicurus was very popular in the ancient world. In fact, Paul would run into some of the Epicureans in Acts chapter 17 at Mars Hill. And Epicurus is also interested in this question of death and the afterlife. And he concluded that basically all that exists is atoms, little particles, and the void. Atoms moving around in the void. And that's it. So all of us are nothing more than collections of atoms. And the good news, says Epicurus, is that when you die, there's no afterlife. That's the good news. And it's the fear of death that keeps us in such turmoil. So if you would stop worrying about the afterlife, you could truly be happy. That's his solution to the problem of death. Now let me suggest to you that we have a much better answer. And it comes to us in a very strange location. Jesus Christ in Matthew chapter 16 comes to a location up in the north of Israel known as Caesarea Philippi. It's way up here in the north. You really can't read that. I recognize that. But here's the Sea of Galilee. And here's the Dead Sea. And Jesus Christ is way up here. And this is a place that is surrounded by idolatry. And in fact, there's huge temples here and all kinds of false gods and worship and so forth. And it's in this context that we find Jesus Christ in Matthew 16 giving us his first teaching about the church. The very first mention of Jesus Christ as to the church. And you should always pay very careful attention to the first mention of anything in the Bible. Usually it has a lot to say. Now, to understand what's going on here, Jesus Christ has been trying to teach his disciples two great truths. Number one, who am I? His identity. And number two, what he's going to do. Up till Matthew chapter 16, Jesus Christ has been demonstrating to his disciples who he really is. The first great truth is his identity. And so he asked them this question in Matthew 16, who do men say that I am? And the disciples say, well, you know, some people say you're John the Baptist, and some people say you're Elijah, and some people say you're Jeremiah. Some people say you're one of those prophets. Okay. But who do you say that I am? And Peter, bold Peter, right away says, I know who you are. Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Okay, Peter's got it. First answer, he's got it right. And right away, Jesus Christ begins to work on that second great truth. What's he going to do? And Jesus Christ says, okay, I'm going to go to Jerusalem now. I'm going to die. And right away, Peter says, no way, that's not going to happen. And Jesus Christ says, Peter, you're Satan. Think of that. This is the harshest possible rebuke that Jesus Christ could deliver to somebody. You're Satan. After this moment of great triumph, he finally recognizes who this is. If you want to find God, you don't go to the temples. He's standing right there. You can reach out and touch him. I'm never going to let you die. Okay, Satan, get behind me. That's intriguing. It's in that context then, when Peter is just probably just weeping at this point and just under consternation what's going on here, that Jesus Christ gives us his first teaching about the church. Let me just show you a few more photographs here. Here is that area in Caesarea Philippi. There used to be a great big temple that was built right into the cave here. And you can just make out some little niches here in the rock where the little gods and statues would have stood. And this is an artist's reconstruction of what it probably looked like in the first century. This would have been the temple to the god Pan over here. And so it's in this context, surrounded by idolatry, that Jesus Christ gives us the first mention of the church. And notice what he says. I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I suggest to you this phrase, the gates of hell, is a phrase that refers to the resurrection. And I realize this is really debated. This is one of those sort of obscure texts, and one of those texts that people wrestle about and debate over and so forth. But let me give you several reasons why I think this actually refers to the resurrection. You know, we have this idea sometimes that this gates of hell refers to some sort of underworld army that's ruled over by Satan, that Satan sits down there on some throne and he has all these demons and so forth. Well, understand, that's a very medieval image. That comes out of Dante's Inferno. It doesn't actually come out of the Bible. Satan is not in hell right now. He does not rule some vast underworld army of people down in hell. That's not where he is. It can't refer to them. Some people think, well, it refers to some sort of armies marching against the church, perhaps. Well, gates don't march. In the ancient world, gates were immobile. It's not what it's talking about. What is it talking about? Christ here is would have recognized this right away as a metaphor for death. Gates refer to an entrance, the entrance to Hades, the entrance to the underworld, the entrance to the grave. The entrance to the grave will not overcome the church. We find this phrase in the Apocrypha. We find it in Maccabees. We find it in Agamemnon. We also find it in Homer's Iliad. It's quite a common phrase in the ancient world. In addition, we find it in Isaiah chapter 38 and verse 10, where Hezekiah is about to die, and the Lord gives him 15 more years of life. And he says, I was about to go into the gates of Sheol, or as the Septuagint translates this, the gates of Hades. But he restores to him life. And then, of course, in the same context, we find Jesus Christ talking about death. I'm going to go to Jerusalem, and I'm going to die. So clearly, this phrase, the gates of hell, refers to death, refers to this process of going into the grave, but that grave will not hold him down. That, I think, is what it's suggesting here. So what does this mean for the gates of hell not to prevail against the church? Well, it means, obviously, that death cannot kill the church's founder. It's impossible. And that's why when we come to Acts chapter 2, in Peter's first sermon at Pentecost, this is what he says. This Jesus, God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death. And notice this. It was impossible. It was not possible for death to hold him. David says concerning him, you will not abandon my soul to Hades or the grave. And Peter claims, brothers, I may say to you with confidence about the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Okay, David died and he's still in the ground. So this can't be referring to David when he refers back to the Psalms. Being therefore a prophet and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that he would set one of his descendants on his throne, he foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of Christ, that he was not abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus God raised up, and of that we are all witnesses. Notice how Peter makes this connection. Peter's the guy back in Matthew 16 that's been really rebuked. He's the guy that says, no way are you going to die. Peter puts it all together. It is impossible for death to hold him. Secondly, death cannot kill his disciples. I think this is the second meaning of the text. What does it mean for death not to overcome the church? Doesn't overcome the founder, doesn't overcome his disciples. Look at this, Matthew 16. Go down a few verses in Matthew 16. Then Jesus told his disciples, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. That's strange. You want to keep your life? You got to lose it. If you lose your life, you maintain it. The early church took these words very literally. When the early church read these words about taking up your cross and following Jesus Christ, they weren't thinking in terms of a bad hair day, a bad roommate, leftovers for dinner, these kinds of things that we tend to think about, right? When Jesus Christ said, take a cross and follow me, they literally took up their crosses and went to the grave for him because they believed that death would not keep them down. That's how they interpreted this. And we'll see this as we move along. And so thirdly, death cannot kill the church. I think this is the third meaning of the text. Whatever this thing is that Jesus is building, it cannot be conquered. It cannot be killed. It cannot be stopped. It was Augustine who recognized this ultimately, that when the whole Roman Empire was crumbling around him, that it was the church that would march on over the wreck of nations and empires. You can't stop this thing. It will grow. It will flourish. It will never cease. It will continue deathless. Now, can we demonstrate that from Scripture? Not necessarily, but I think that we can demonstrate that through a look at persecution in the early church. And that's why I refer to this next section as Rome's greatest failure, the persecution of the church. Just like all three of those ancient civilizations that we talked about last time came to pressure the Messiah, to crush the Messiah, but could not keep him in the grave, so too these three great civilizations, the Jewish civilization, the Greek civilization, the Roman civilization, would attempt to crush the church. And by the time we come into the 5th century and 6th century, we find all those civilizations disappearing and the church emerges triumphant. This is the story of persecution in the early church. Understand that for the first 3 centuries of its existence, Christianity was illegal. You were not allowed to be a Christian. Imagine that. It's illegal to be a follower of Jesus Christ. Now, let me give you several reasons why the church was persecuted, why Christians were persecuted in the early church. And of course, this persecution has continued unto this day. There are Christians being persecuted all around the world. But why initially were the Christians persecuted? Well, first of all, there were a whole number of religious factors. Christianity was viewed as a threat to the existing religious establishment. As I mentioned last time, Rome venerated everything that's old. Anything that's, you know, several centuries old or 1,000 years old or 2,000 years old and has some sticking power, this is good. And so Rome was very tolerant of many different religions. Rome was a very pluralistic culture. They borrowed gods from the Greeks and from the Indians and from the barbarians even, and they just sort of brought them all together into this mixture. But when they looked at Christianity, they thought, well, this is something new. And if this is new, where has it been for all these years? It must not really have met with the gods' favor. And so therefore, it needs to be crushed. Understand also that Romans viewed religion as a kind of insurance policy. And they were not doctrinal in their thinking about their gods. Basically, they were obsessed with ritual. And so if you have a poor harvest, what you do is you go out and you offer more sacrifices to gods. Or if there's rough seas, you know, when you're trying to travel across the Mediterranean, you know, you got to appease the gods somehow by offering more sacrifices and keep the gods happy. And by doing so, you'll keep them at bay and they won't deliver any kind of punishment to us down here below. And the Christians were dismissive of all this. And so anytime something bad happens, anytime there's a storm, anytime there's a poor harvest, they just assume it's the Christians' fault because they're not keeping the gods happy. They're not worshiping the gods. They're not offering incense and so forth. So anytime anything bad happens, who gets the blame automatically? It's the Christians, of course. In addition, there were a variety of political factors. The Christians were viewed as treasonous. After all, you have to understand that Jesus Christ spent more time talking about the kingdom than he did the church. In fact, Jesus Christ only mentions the church twice, Matthew 16 and Matthew 18. But nearly every other time that we find him speaking in the Gospels, he's talking about the kingdom. And this makes the Romans very mistrustful of Christians. What is this kingdom you're talking about? Another king? Another Caesar? What is this? And so all kinds of libel were issued against the church as being treacherous, as being treasonous, as throwing off the Roman yoke. In addition, Christians were persecuted for economic reasons. Paul, of course, runs into this in Athens. in Ephesus. He comes in, he begins to preach, and here's Demetrius. He's been selling all these idols. People start converting. Guess what? They don't buy the idols anymore. Well, if this is your trade and this is how you feed your family, you're going to be very mad. In addition, there were all kinds of false accusations that were brought against the Christians. And one of the most surprising is the accusation of cannibalism. Anyone know why the Christians would have been accused of cannibalism? Yes. Yeah, we know what they do. They go into these secret meetings and they eat somebody's body and they drink his blood. You know, the communion service. They just misinterpreted this as some sort of cannibalistic ritual. Christians were also accused of atheism. And in fact, according to the Romans, they were atheists because they didn't believe in this whole pantheon of the gods. Christians would walk into a city and there's all these idols, and Christians were like, those aren't real gods. Well, you guys are atheists then. Imagine that, Christians called atheists. And they were also accused of immorality. Because again, oftentimes when they're meeting in secret, they're meeting in hiding and so forth, all kinds of scandalous things would come out. Well, you know what these Christians do. They go over here and they meet in these secret little meetings over here. And nah, yeah, I think they were immoral in there and so forth. So all kinds of accusations leveled against the church. Well, the persecution of the Christians can be divided into three different periods. Let's take a look. Or three stages. The first one runs from about 30 AD to 109. And we call this the local stage. This is the stage in which we find Saul of Tarsus inaugurating the persecution in Acts chapter 8, followed by Nero and then Domitian. In this stage, Christianity is still relatively small. It's sprouting up in different locations. And here and there, these persecutions begin. They begin in Jerusalem. With Saul, of course, and Saul is in this containment strategy. He learns that these Christians are also in Damascus, so he goes to the high priest. He says, okay, can you give me papers? Let's go up to Damascus and stop the Christians here as well. It's very local. And frankly, you could live in some locations and be perfectly free. In other locations, you would have been murdered for your faith. In the 60s, Christianity apparently had really grown in Rome. And what's amazing about this is that Christianity really infiltrates the city of Rome long before Paul ever gets there. We think of Paul as sort of in the vanguard of the missions movement, right? Well, Paul writes a letter to the Romans before he ever gets there. And who is he writing to? There's a whole church there that he's addressing. So very early, Christianity begins to permeate the capital of the empire. In fact, we read that in 52 A.D., the emperor expelled all the Christians, anyone who believes in this person called Christus, which is Christ. He expels them from the city. And then the 60s, apparently Christianity had become so strong that Nero succeeds in blaming them for the burning of the city of Rome. Now, we don't know exactly what happened. We do know that Rome burned. Tacitus is our best source on this, the Roman historian, and he is not a great friend of the Christians, but he really doesn't like Nero. And so he seems to indicate that it was Nero that was responsible for burning Rome. And there's, you know, it's quite possible. Nero was a madman. He made one of his horses a senator and killed his teacher as well as his mother, and was at one occasion in a chariot race in the Olympics and fell out of his chariot and still managed to win first place. Because he's the emperor. Nobody can say no to the emperor, right? And so he's demented in every way possible. Well, Rome ends up being burned over the course of about a week. And Nero needs a scapegoat, so he simply blames the Christians. And Tacitus tells us that the persecution was fierce. They would take Christians and they would put them inside of animal skins and then throw them to the wild animals. He would use Christians to light his gardens at night. They would just burn their bodies and so forth, all kinds of diabolical things. And it's probably the case that Paul dies during this time of persecution by having his head lopped off. We don't know for sure. But again, this is localized. Persecution in Jerusalem, persecution in Rome. Domitian as well was a persecuting emperor. He is the one, by the way, who exiles John to the island of Patmos. Under his reign, it's probably then that we get the book of Revelation. Well, after this local stage, we move into a regional stage. And again, as Christianity grows, so does the persecution. This regional stage, most historians will date to a famous letter that comes from Pliny, who was the governor of Bithynia, to Trajan, the emperor. And Pliny sends this letter and essentially says, look, we found these Christians and this is my policy when I deal with Christians. I don't go on a witch hunt and try to find them out, but whenever I do find Christians and I begin to question them, if they don't confess that their religion is false, then I torture them. In some cases, I kill them and so forth. And he basically is just trying to butter up the emperor and make him feel, you know, like Pliny is his, you know, good right-hand man. And Trajan writes back and he says, that's a good policy. Let's just keep doing that. And that actually becomes the policy of the empire. You don't have to go hunt the Christians down. You don't have to actually seek them out deliberately. But anytime you bring a Christian in before the court of law, if you discover that he's a Christian through whatever means possible, then it's okay to torture them. Then it's okay to kill them. So during this stage of persecution, again, it's somewhat sporadic. We see it here, we see it there, but it is becoming more of a empire-wide occurrence. And finally, we come to the universal stage, beginning in 250, running down to the year 313. This begins with Decius and runs down to the persecution of Diocletian. In the year 250, Rome begins to celebrate its millennial birthday. According to tradition, it was founded by Romulus and Remus back in about 750, and now 750 BC, and now the Roman Empire is 1,000 years old. And yet there's real pressure. The empire is beginning to contract. There's barbarians that are putting pressure on the borders from Europe, and there's a series of bad harvest and so forth. And so things aren't looking very well for the empire. And Decius is wondering, well, why is this? You know what? It must be that the gods are angry. It must be that they're not happy with us because we have people that aren't worshiping them. And who are these people that aren't worshiping the gods? Oh, it's the Christians. It's the Christians. And so he inaugurates an empire-wide campaign to eliminate Christians. And here's what he does. He requires that anyone who goes to offer sacrifice to the gods receive a libellus. A libellus is basically a certificate that says, hey, look, I sacrificed. And of course, the Christians would never sacrifice to the gods, and so they would never get a libellus. And so anytime you found somebody without a libellus, you could just persecute them. And this was his means of detecting the Christians. Some early fathers thought this was sort of the mark of the beast. You know, the 666 has something to do with the libellus. I don't know that that's the right interpretation, but it is interesting nevertheless. And then we come down to Diocletian. Diocletian is the worst of the worst. I think of him as sort of the Hitler of the ancient world. He inaugurates a threefold plan to finally exterminate the church. Here's what he does. Number one, destroy all the church buildings. Every last one of them, destroy them all. In addition to that, all the literature. Any Bibles you can find, just destroy anything that smacks of Christianity. Number two, torture and kill the clergy. Anybody who's a pastor, get rid of them. No questions asked, kill the clergy. And then thirdly, continuing Decius's practice, kill all Christians who refuse to sacrifice to the gods. So beginning in the year 303 and running all the way down to the year 311, this practice was instituted. And they went on this empire-wide search for all Christians. And the persecutions were fierce. Incredible. Eusebius tells us with some rhetorical flair that eventually the animals just got so tired of eating the Christians. And that the soldiers quit killing the Christians because their swords were too blunt. This persecution just ravaged the church. But something very interesting happened. The church did not die. The church actually grew. Eusebius writes, the martyrdoms occurred in all varieties, like so many shapes and colors of flowers woven into one crown to offer the Father. This is how they thought of their death. We're making this crown to give to the Father. Or Tertullian, all your ingenious cruelties can accomplish nothing. They are only a lure to the sect. Our number increases the more you destroy us. The blood of Christians is their seed. He didn't say seed of the church, but he did say their seed. We are a people of yesterday, and yet we have filled every place belonging to you, cities, islands, castles, towns, assemblies, your very camp, your tribes, companies, palace, senate, forum. We leave you your temples only. We can count your armies, our numbers in a single province will be greater. He is not exaggerating. The more they try to crush this thing called the church, the more the thing explodes. How do you account for that? It's because these Christians took up their cross to follow Christ, because they believed that to die was to live. To die for Christ was to be resurrected. You cannot kill this thing. You cannot stop this thing. And this is why I call it Rome's greatest failure. It utterly fails to kill the church. And so finally, in the year 311, Galerius, who was the junior emperor to Diocletian, issues an edict of toleration. He writes, "They may again be Christians and may hold their conventicles, provided they do nothing contrary to good order." And notice this, "Wherefore, for this our indulgence, they ought to pray to their God for our safety." He's a little bit fearful. "For that of the Republic and for their own, that the Republic may continue uninjured on every side, and that they may be able to live securely in their homes." You know, what's interesting is these Roman emperors actually started to get a little bit nervous about this thing. I mean, we've been killing these people, and they just keep multiplying. I mean, there's some sort of God at work in this whole thing. Would you pray for us? Yeah, we're killing you, but would you please pray for us? All right. And then comes Constantine, who was a general that will become emperor. He's up in York, England, and he comes down to Rome. And I will say more about him on a later occasion. But in the year 313, he issues a famous edict of Milan, in which he says, "It has pleased us to remove all conditions whatsoever concerning the Christians, and now any one of these who wishes to observe Christian religion may do so freely and openly without molestation. We have given to those Christians free and unrestricted opportunity of religious worship. And all this conscripted property ought to be delivered at once to the community of the churches through your intercession, and without any delay. The churches you will order to be restored without any hesitation or controversy at all to these Christians." Imagine this reversal. They go from being persecuted, from 303 to 311, and now they're completely free. And in fact, the emperor himself will claim to convert to Christianity. We'll have to assess that claim. All right, I'm a little bit skeptical, but he certainly abandons paganism. This is remarkable. Jesus Christ said, "The gates of Hades will not prevail." You can't kill this thing. That's why we're sitting here today. We have a resurrected Lord, and he is the head of this church and all churches, and it will not die. It will be here as long as the world endures, and it will grow. And Jesus Christ said, you know, it's like a little mustard seed that someone takes and he plants it in the ground. He said on another occasion that a grain of wheat has to go into the ground and die, and then it grows. It becomes a great tree, and the birds of the air can come and nest in this thing. That's what's been going on for the last 2,000 years. This is why church history is so important. It's not just events and people and dates. It's what Jesus Christ said that's actually coming to pass. I get really excited about this. I mean, Jesus said certain things are going to happen, and we are the result of that. Jesus Christ said to go into all the world with the gospel. When he's standing in Jerusalem saying that, guess where the uttermost part of the world is? It's like Palmetto, South Carolina. This is a long, long way away from where Jesus spoke that command. And yet the church is thriving here. How do you account for that? Well, let me just tell you about a few of these martyrs in the time that I have remaining. Just give you some of the names here. I might come back and mention a few more next time. One of the most famous is a man named Polycarp of Smyrna. I don't have a picture of him, but he was burned at the stake for his faith in the year 155. Polycarp was a disciple of John, a second-generation Christian, and pastored this church for many, many years in Smyrna. And eventually, the authorities received an edict to arrest him, and they came to find him in his home, and he was ready to go. They took him to be burned. They asked him to recant his faith, and he responded, 85 years I have served him, and he has done me no wrong. How then can I betray my Savior who bought me?" They burned him alive at 85 years of age. Or you have Ignatius of Antioch. Ignatius, according to tradition, was the little boy that sat on Jesus' lap. Probably tradition, all right? But also a disciple of John. And he is one of the early church fathers that actually bridges the gap from the disciples into the later more famous church fathers. A clear second generation follower of Christ. And he is arrested and he is brought to Rome and he is thrown to the wild beast. And when you read his writings, he almost has this unhealthy desire for martyrdom. He says, "Oh, let me be the wheat of God that I may be ground in the teeth of the wild beast." In fact, he tells the Romans, "Don't do anything to prevent my martyrdom. I want to die for the sake of Jesus Christ." I don't know that we have to go that far, but he certainly felt that was appropriate. One of my favorite stories is the story of Perpetua and Felicitas, these two ladies. This is from the year 203. These two ladies in the church, one was an owner, one was a servant. Perpetua was the owner. The master. And both of these ladies were pregnant, and Perpetua was about 9 months pregnant. Felicitas was 8 months pregnant. They had been arrested for their faith, and there was a law in Rome that prevented the martyrdom of a pregnant woman. You had to wait till she delivered her child, and then you could actually persecute her. Then you could put her to death. Well, while in prison, Perpetua gave birth to her son, and gave her son up to her father, who was a pagan. And he came to her trial as she stood for the sake of Christ. And he brought that little boy and he held that boy up. And he pled with her to recant her faith for the sake of her son. You can only imagine how hard this would be. There's just nothing almost more close and sacred than the relationship between a mother and her child. And here's the father holding this child up. "Please, please, for the sake of your son, just recant Christ." And she refused. "I will not do that." Well, Felicitas, her servant, was still pregnant, and she was very, very concerned that if Perpetua preceded her into the Colosseum there in Carthage and was killed, that she would not have the faith that she needed and that she would recant her faith. And so she prayed and she asked the Lord to be delivered of her child at 8 months. And the Lord answered. And she gave birth to this child. And there was a soldier that looked on and seeing her birth pangs, felt very moved for her. And he said, "Why don't you just recant your faith?" And referring to her birth pangs, she said these words, "Now I suffer what I suffer. But then he shall suffer for me." She was reflecting Paul's words, or Christ's words to Paul. "Paul, Paul, or Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me?" She believed that when she went into that Colosseum, she wasn't going to suffer because Christ was in her. Think of the faith of this woman. And sure enough, they were both taken out to the Colosseum there. This picture is a little bit overdone, but they were, you don't see it here, it doesn't show up. Right over here, oops, I'm sorry, there's a bull with big horns, and it's this bull that actually rams them and takes their life. The story of Perpetua and Felicitas. A couple more here. On the right here you see St. Catherine of Alexandria, and I do have to mention that sometimes these accounts get really embellished, especially by the Roman Catholic Church. St. Catherine supposedly was a brilliant woman. I have no reason to doubt this. But she was brought into trial, and her tormentors came and tried to get her to recant her faith, and she answered with such wisdom and skill that no one could trip her up in her words. And so they decided to torture her with this great wheel with these spikes that came off of it. And it was supposed to just rip your body to shreds. And according to the legend, she reached out with a finger and touched the thing, and the whole thing just dissolved. And so they lopped off her head instead. And a great eagle came and carried her body. And it's buried today at Mount Sinai, at St. Catherine's Monastery at Mount Sinai. And this is where one of the great manuscripts of the Old Testament was found, Sinaiticus. You probably remembered some of that, some of you in Bible doctrine. Sinaiticus, yes, it was found at the monastery that was named in her honor. And then St. Lucy. You see St. Lucy here, and she is holding a little bowl here with her eyeballs in it. According to tradition, her eyes were gouged out. And she becomes sort of a patron saint to those with any kind of physical maladies, those who need, those who can't see. She becomes like a guide to Dante in the afterlife and so on and so forth. So, you know, some of these are real people. My point is that they really did suffer. And it's unfortunate the Roman Catholic Church has come along and sort of really embellish these things. And they've turned these martyrs into these saints that we can almost worship and we can, you know, get merit from them and so forth. But we want to be careful that we don't allow that to undermine the fact that these are real people who did, in fact, suffer for God and would have been appalled had they known what the Roman Catholic Church later did with their reputations. Here is St. Sebastian, who, according to tradition, was shot full of arrows, and he becomes the patron saint for those suffering from the bubonic plague. So if you get the bubonic plague, St. Sebastian apparently can help you. Well, what happens as a result of the persecution? The church is going to explode. The church continues to grow. You can't crush this thing. At the same time, we will find the development of the hierarchy, and I'll say more about this in coming weeks. Because of this pressure on the church, there is a need for very strong leadership, and you understand they haven't decided on the canon yet. And so very early we see this development of bishops and archbishops and so forth. And that's going to accomplish some good things, but eventually that's going to grow into Roman Catholicism as well. And a third thing that persecution is going to do is force the church to recognize the canon of Scripture. There are lots of books out there that were claiming to be God's Word, and we now know them as apocryphal or pseudepigraphal. But what is it that caused the church to really recognize certain books as belonging to the canon? Well, what kind of books are you going to die for? What are you going to die for? You're going to die for the words of the apostles. And it really does force upon the church the need to decide the canon. Well, that's all we have time for, I'm sorry, but we will come back to this in a couple weeks.